start going chug, 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 chug. Eddie. A couple of little announcements as we wait for Joseph Cohen, an attorney who used to work for the United Electrical Workers. I used to work for them, too. A long time ago now, but anyway. But we're going to wait for him to call in, and then in the meantime, I'm going to update you a little bit on some local events here in the area that are going to take place. I think Joseph Cohen is going to be talking about one of them, which is the Let the People Vote event, okay, which is about the challenge of who is going to get to vote here in the... there's going to be rallies of various kinds. This is a note about the rally. Okay, but we'll let Joseph, you know, get in and talk about that when he decides to tune in. I must have some other notices from my little progressive confluence thing here. Let's see. Protect the internet. well, this is a fight for the future. This is trying to keep... the big corporations from overcharging everybody else on the internet, you know, and using it all up themselves. Okay, that's part of it. There's going to be action to save 1 million trees. Forget time. We'll get some of that. It's going to go on too. There's different things you can get involved with here in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. And, check our blog at enlightenedradio.org. Oh, here we go. Now we got the call. Good morning. You're calling into Enlightened Radio, and this is the Winners and Losers Radio program. Who's calling?
This is Joseph Cohen and Eli Bomwell, the ACLU of West Virginia.
Eli and Joseph, it's nice to. Eli, were you also in our studio in Shepherdstown before?
Yeah.
I think you were, yes, right. Okay, great. It's wonderful to have you guys call in. Joseph Cohen, also we share a past employer, I think, the United Electrical Workers at some point. And welcome to the program again. I enjoyed having you guys on last time. And tell me about this campaign to let the vote, what's it called exactly? You've got a name for the campaign here. Let People Vote. Tell us about what that's about.
Yeah, let people vote. This is probably the biggest grassroots action the ACLU has ever taken nationally. There's going to be a campaign with 50 state-specific strategies on increasing access to the polls, fighting voter suppression laws, and just expanding democracy across the country. And you know, we've worked with the ACLU's membership has quadrupled since the election, and we've been working hard to figure out a way to, mobilize all these new people who are involved,
right,
in a way that maybe the ACLU hasn't in the past. You know, we're traditionally been viewed as lawyers and lobbyists, but with all these new members, we think we've got some extra muscle. So we decided that one of the first things we're going to tackle is voting rights, because it's so fundamental to democracy.
It's a great choice, actually. I mean, considering the circumstances we are all in here, let me ask you a question though about that, because I was informed some time ago that county clerks who are elected, I think it was the Republican Secretary of State currently now, I can't remember his name at the moment, but anyway, it turns out that the county clerks are kind of in charge of maintaining their voting rolls, right? And or they have a big influence on it, like how fast they purge them of dead people, et cetera, or not record people. And what constitutes, valid registration and not? I know there's statutes, but what? So when you say state by state, like in West Virginia, what approach should be taken to, like, the county clerks? I was told by the Secretary of State, for example, that they don't like to be ordered since they're elected officials. Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so you probably know that the state is in the midst of a purging process right now, and they've purged tens of thousands of names from the voter rolls, tens of thousands. And we know that certainly, you know, we do have a lot of stale registrants. You know, we've had a lot of people move out of the state, and there are a lot of dead people on the list. But we also are worried, and we know that at least some people who are eligible voters have been purged from the list. So we're keeping a really very, very close eye on the process that they're using and evaluating it. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now out of Ohio. It's going to be heard in October that the state of Ohio uses a very similar process as the state of West Virginia in purging their voter rolls.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to be keeping an eye, depending on what happens at the Supreme Court in the Ohio case, that's going to have a big impact on our evaluation as to whether or not West Virginia's process for purging the voter rolls is legal or not. But part of the call to action in West Virginia that we're going to have as part of this People Power, Let People Vote movement is regarding the purging of the voter rolls. So, you know, since the county election of county clerks are elected officials, they are susceptible to popular action, you know?
Yes,
so
they are.
People think they're elected officials, and
right.
They're not used to being
right.
to running. They're not used to running in opposed races, maybe. They're
mm-hmm.
not used to voting. Keeping an eye on them. So in some ways, they may be more susceptible to popular, you know, uprising, so to speak,
yes.
than other officials. So they're not used to getting phone calls. They're not used to getting letters or letters to the editor about them.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that this campaign, a campaign that may partially be targeted at county clerks could be particularly effective, actually.
Well, that's very interesting. And because our county is in Jefferson County, of course, up here, Jefferson and Berkeley, although I tend to focus on Jefferson, we've been taken over by a band of lunatics in the county commission. And I don't know how to describe them accurately without, you know, sinking into, you know, a new version of the Moose Turd Cafe, you know, but it's just, it's very unpredictable. I mean, you got two ideologues and one idiot, you know, that are just can't seem to, you know, it doesn't matter what you say to them. Okay, so I'm afraid of what... But the county clerk is independently elected. You're correct, and that makes that's an interesting angle on which to focus. Actually, it really is. Yeah,
it's a pressure point, and in our experience, you know, we sue county clerks. I mean, we deal with them sometimes, and just generally, and they run the gamut. There are great county clerks. There are terrible county clerks. They really do run the gamut. But in our experience, most of them are not what I would consider ideologues in any way. They're, even though they're elected, they're
mm-hmm.
usually very long-term employees, and they're
yeah.
they're it's
yeah.
almost more like a bureaucratic or civil servant position,
right.
even though they're elected. So, like most bureaucrats, their concerns tend to run, you know, more towards the common sense or what's the path of least resistance.
Exactly.
And if we need to, through things like People Power or all the amazing organizing that's going on around the state, we can create resistance. That may be the path of least resistance is to make it easier for people to vote.
Do you have go ahead. Either of you have a sense of how much the voting disfranchised voters, I'm thinking mainly working class and poor people, okay, have been disenfranchised or are not able to vote for reasons of some insufficiency in the law. Well, who are we losing? How many are we losing in the process that we could have participate?
So in West Virginia, we know that already there have been tens of thousands of people who've been taken off the poll rolls. We don't know how many of them are active voters yet, but we have reason to suspect that there's going to be a good number. And in fact, the New York Times just published a study out of Wisconsin, where Wisconsin has a very strict voter ID law. And what they found was that 17,000 voters were actually turned away there. So that was 17,000 real people who showed up to vote were turned away based on the strict voter ID law. So we can extrapolate that a little bit. And again, based on what we know about how many people have been purged here in West Virginia, and make some assumptions that we're looking at probably thousands of people who are potentially either having their registration canceled or could potentially be turned away, especially if our voter ID law goes into effect.
Okay, so, well, I mean, do we have is it possible to get access, for example, to, you know, each list as it is revised? Is that a public record of any kind, or do you have to go sue to get everything, you know?
So we have filed targeted Freedom of Information Act requests with certain county clerks because they're the ones who maintain the county-by-county list.
Right.
We've gotten some information that's helpful in determining this. We've had other information that, we have to think long and hard about whether we've gotten the information we've requested or if we're going to have to go to court over it. And you can get this information from the Secretary of State as well. It's just a massive amount of information. But the
right.
Secretary of State does publish, I think it's monthly, the voter registration by party in every county. Now, it's not name by name, and some people, of course, may have moved or changed
Correct.
Their registration proactively. Some people may have registered proactively. But if you look at these months, people are not generally registering to vote in huge numbers in, say, January after the election, right?
Yeah.
And we have seen, and we looked at those numbers county by county. In fact, I have it in front of me right now, and there has been a shocking change in registration in some counties, in the first 6 months of this year.
Really? How so? How's that been going? Yeah. How's it been changed?
Well, I'm just looking at this list, and for example, in the first 5 months of 2016, which is a time when you would not expect huge numbers of people to be changing or registering to vote. It's a non-election. It's right after an election. There were 66,337 people in Cabell County who left the voter rolls. I'll do Jefferson County, where you are. Give me 1 second. In Jefferson, compare that to Jefferson County, where there were only 269 people who left or were purged from the rolls. So although in Jefferson County, what's interesting is 251 of those 269 people were Democrats. And that's something we see county after county after county is there is, and it could just be the demographics of the state. If these are in fact dead people, the West Virginia was a heavily Democratic state, when these people were alive, and it's less so now. So there is a demographic explanation for this, but we see it over and over again in every county.
So it's suspicious too. It is.
It's something we need to really look hard at and dig deeply into.
Well, for example, I mean, each county, if you really dig into it, are they, what the methodology they use, whatever it is, okay? I mean, how much of it is the made up on that they do? What I mean, for example, what's the difference between electronically maintained and non-electronic records? I doubt that every county is every county electronified yet, or if it is it in little private files, or is it sitting on cloud servers someplace, or right? I mean, how do you reconcile? Are they harmonious? Can they all be reconciled? I mean, the Secretary of State is getting something directly, but is it all coming in electronically?
Again, this has been one of the interesting things with this new Secretary of State. They really push counties to use electronic records. And one of the things that they've been pushing is cross-checking. So they've got a number of different systems that they use. They check with the Social Security system to look for people who are dead. They can check with the driver license system to check, confirm addresses. The two big programs that are out there, though, that we're really following, one state uses is called CrossCheck, and this is a real problematic program. Nationally, when we've looked at it, I believe the numbers are there are about 200 cases that are identified as potential fraud for every one that's actually a duplicate vote. So this is just a wildly inaccurate program. There's another program out there that's ERIC, and that's the electronic registration. Electronic registration and information system, similar to that line. That's a much more active program. The state actually works with both. And one of the things that we're really hoping that we can do is move away from this wildly inaccurate cross-check program, which is favored by people like Chris Kobach, for the more accurate ERIC program. But those are some of the electronic programs right. that the Secretary of State is looking to.
I mean, in general, I mean, do we look at at making everything electronic as a positive or negative event? I mean, do you have an opinion on this? I don't see how you're going to stop it from becoming increasingly electronic, but so maybe it's a moot debate at some level. But
it certainly got some benefits in terms of mass data management, in terms of keeping track of a large database and a rapidly changing database. There are concerns in terms of, again, false positives for potential duplicate votes, particularly with this cross-check program. There are also concerns with privacy, and we've seen how many systems have been illegally accessed, have been hacked.
Right.
Years. So we always want to make sure that data is being secured appropriately, particularly when you're using things like the Social Security Administration, Social Security numbers as well.
Yeah.
So that's always going to be a concern, and we're always keeping an eye towards privacy as well. But I think you're right that it's going to be the way of the future, and it's really incumbent on our elected officials to take the appropriate steps to make sure that this data remains private.
Yeah, obviously the hacking attempts, I guess, Russia has been accused of doing this, right, with some state machines that were vulnerable, or I'm not sure what the actual net damage was, but that's right. So if a foreign country or entity is doing it, I know from experience in computer systems that the perfect security model does not exist unless you unplug everything. Then you have to go back to the old security models, which weren't perfect either. But I think finding it's tough to find a way, in a world in which appears so divided, and the divisions seem so sharp now, as sharp as I remember, even well, I'm not sure you can compare the '60s, but. It's getting there, if not worse in some respects, and dialogue starts to break down, and I see it can infect anything, including automated systems. Right, that's my concern.
Yeah. I think the one of the main points you made there is we're already at the point where this is all electronic. It's all electronic at this point, essentially, and having that power and having that data in the hands of responsible people who want to ensure that we have clean, fair, fully participated elections is vital, and people just don't. That's why the last thing people think about before they go to the voting booth is, who am I gonna vote for county clerk? Or maybe I should run for county clerk. Has that entered into people's minds? But we really think that people need to be more involved in an active way in the elections process.
Well, this raises the question, maybe it's related to what you're talking about here, because, for example, a lot of conversation, national conversation, now takes place on social media. Okay. A lot of the ways in which people participate in politics, now we have the issue of, you know, these social media networks are run by private corporations for profit, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. They're operating on a business model of some kind, and that's the motivating thing going on, they obviously cannot neglect. All right. But then it raises a big question, right, about, okay, someone paid me a certain amount of money, a foreign government, you know, to launch a whole bunch of bots onto Facebook with the purpose of, slanting an election toward a particular candidate, right, or against a particular candidate. And, fake news of a very large order, right, and being organized there's an old commentary on free speech some Russian revolutionary, I remember, was responsible for, it's free for those that own the means of speech, okay? And where are we headed in the free speech territory? Do you have any thoughts? I know you think about this because you guys are civil rights lawyers, about, for example, Facebook. What is Facebook responsible to do? I mean, and do we have a right to demand some level of censorship, some level of whatever, or transparency? What direction should the answer even go in?
These are complex issues. First of all, I point out that as unique as this era is, the idea that the debate being owned by private corporations is a new phenomenon. I don't think is really true. I mean, the debate before the era of social media was primarily held on TV programs and in the newspapers. We can certainly have a lot of discussion about how much more accurate or less accurate news was during those times, but those are still private corporations. So the profit motive in the debate, I think, has always been there. This is a unique era, though, in terms of fake news, in terms of fake stories, in terms of how people can be targeted very directly with this sort of information or misinformation. My leaning is always going to be towards free speech, and I think what we are going through here is a social evolution where, rather than having one sort of official narrative that comes from some of the major networks or the major newspapers, there's going to be a lot of different versions of the truth, and what we're going to see is sort of a social evolution where we are going to have to get smarter and better about filtering out what is good and reliable information, what's not, and that's going to be a challenge that's going to be growing pains, but I think when you balance that out versus any sort of suppression of speech, that's got to be the way to go. The responsibility has to be with us, the people, to be educated and participate in our democracy.
And John, one of the things that's been interesting to me is, I get on Facebook or whatever, and I see these stories pop up my feed, and they just sound absolutely ridiculous. So I'll just really Google the story, and it's not covered by any other media outlet except democracytoday.com or wherever the link is coming from, this ridiculous site. And it's obvious to me that it's fake news, but I can't believe how many people just believe whatever it is that they're seeing, whatever it is that they're reading. If it's on the internet, it must be true. And we get a ton of requests. We're going to be putting together a presentation on fake news, on how to, how a person can determine what's real and what's fake. And it's kind of surprising to me how often we get that request, how many people are struggling with this issue. For me, I think Facebook is essentially It's essentially the modern commons. And for that reason, I think people can demand some transparency or some greater understanding of how these algorithms work or how they're getting targeted with news or fake things that appear to be news. I think as a news outlet, Facebook sort of has, people can demand that there is an accountability. I mean, Facebook is attempting to become the news outlet. But I would echo what Eli said, for example, in the late 19th century, the Gilded Age or around the time of the Revolution, there were like incredibly partisan newspapers that were, for one side or the other.
Oh, Thomas Paine. Yes, sure. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he's fake news, but there was tons of fake news back then.
Yeah, well, I think the some people thought of it as fake news. You can get right wing. I'm sure you could got the. I bet the king thought it was fake news. it's a challenge. I know this is an issue that's going to get just more complicated as it goes. You're right. Part of growing up in the new, interconnected world is you do have to find ways to determine what's fake and what's not. And of course, what's fake and what's not is probably as next to the subject-object problem is probably the oldest problem in philosophy. So you've undertaken, in teaching people how to do that, you're almost pursuing a Socratic mission.
I'll tell you what is fake news. And here's one problem we have is that the President of the United States has co-opted the term. The term fake news, I had never heard that as a term until right around election time when these honestly fake stories were popping up that Hillary had a pedophilia ring out of a pizza shop. I mean, that was fake. That did not happen. And then the President starts calling CNN fake news because he doesn't like their coverage. That is not the same thing. CNN is not fake news. It may be a perspective that somebody doesn't like, but it's not fake. Hillary was not a pedophile. There's no evidence of that. That is fake. The term fake news has to, what is fake and what is real, we can't have that taken away from our eyes. Some things happen and some things do not happen.
It's part of the, not unrelated, right, to this attack on science, right?
Exactly.
You can't know anything. How do you know? You know, that kind of thing, right?
So. What was the term Kellyanne Conway used?
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts.
Yeah, right.
No, there are facts and there are things that are not true.
Well, I mean, there's a whole industry around merchants of doubt, people who just want to throw doubt into what was otherwise known for their own gain. And again, that's going to be, I think, something that we're going to have to find a way to address. And we have to find a way to address it in a way that's going to protect people's rights to express themselves. It's been coming on us to become more aware citizens, right?
I think possibly. I mean, I think, for example, if Russia wants to buy some bots from Facebook. Or any other country, I don't know, pick on Russia, but I'm sure I have no doubt that the United States has done this in other countries. I have no doubt, okay? Interfered with elections, okay? But if someone wants to buy the bots from Facebook, maybe Facebook should say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put Russian bot on the bottom.
Right.
At least, right? I mean, is transparency. I think transparency is, if we're going to have all this incredible diversity in the world, then somehow transparency, or the ability to get to something if you want to and need to, is maybe the most important thing of all. I noticed when Thomas Piketty wrote his book with this, this new famous equation of trying to describe what happens to capitalism in every 100 years or something. Anyway, he has this big theory, but he says, "Well, what can you do about it?" Everyone says you can't do anything about that. I mean, you've almost described a state of nature. And he says, "Well, no." He says, "The key is transparency." He says, "Once all the nations of the world are keeping their books correctly, you know, then the obvious is in front of you. I thought that was a really interesting approach, you know. So transparency, and I think, important. Yeah, go ahead.
We're making a we have a long term campaign at the ACLU West Virginia on protecting democracy and civic engagement, and part of that is increasing transparency in our government here in West Virginia. And I have to say, it's really a pretty refreshing to me that, and Eli, correct me if you have a different opinion, because Eli's our main guy at the Capitol. He's our primary lobbyist. There is bipartisan support. There is support amongst the Republican caucus for increasing transparency on campaign donations, on, you know, where the money is coming from sometimes, right? But there is this, like, sort of bipartisan understanding that people have a right to know what's going on in their government.
It's game theory at its best. This is a situation where the Republicans don't trust the Democrats are playing on the level, and the Democrats don't trust the Republicans are playing on the level, and we can continue sort of this go down two different paths in this part of the sort of more partisan nature, or we can shine the light on everyone. And the resistance always comes from it when they realize that they're going to have the light shined on them as well. That's from both sides. But everyone wants to see what the other guy is doing and where the other guy is getting their money.
Yeah.
The other guy or the other gal. So there is actually support for that.
Well, I think that's the important point to go. But we're almost at the end of our little segment here, and so I was going to ask you guys maybe to maybe you could spell out some ways that if people want more information, who would they go to, and also maybe how can people in this area in Jefferson County anyway get more involved in the get out the vote. Campaign.
This Sunday night at 7 o'clock, there's going to be watch parties or gatherings around the state. There are none in Jefferson County, although there is one right across the border in Maryland. But I would encourage people to stick with West Virginia because these are state by state issues. But if they go to the website, the live stream is going to start at 7:30. They go to the website peoplepower.org. There is going to be a live stream. And then they can get directly in touch with me, okay, or us at the ACLU of West Virginia by emailing us at mail@acluwv.org, mail@acluwv.org, and we will get them hooked up with all the information they need. The people power concept really is about, it's not about us in Charleston running the show. It really is about sort of grassroots activists taking control and taking the lead in this, but we can help them make that possible and give them the information that they need. So 7:30 Sunday night at peoplepower.org is probably the best way to get involved if you're up in Jefferson County.
Okay, well, Joseph and Eli, I want to thank you guys so much for chiming in today. If you want to have one more last word, you can, but I love talking to you guys, and it's very informative, and appreciate what you're doing on this, focusing on keeping the voters, the real ones, enrolled, and more of them, and making it easy for new ones to sign up too, as well, right?
And I want to thank you for having us on, John. And I guess the last thing I would say is that, you know, this notion of voter fraud and that our election system is not secure is not true. We do have a very serious problem in this country when it comes to our voting habits, and that's simply that not enough people are involved, not enough people are registered, and not enough people turn out to the polls. And we need to do everything we can to ensure that it's as easy as possible for as many people as possible to vote.
Okay. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon, okay? I'll put this this podcast will be up here this afternoon. I'll send you a link to it, okay? Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.